technology just to begin with, it would be really useful for me to know who in the room is already familiar with phenomenology. So it's fine for me to be quite, to take a sort of quite basic route, and that's great. So I will begin. So the talk is called Starting From Below, Phenomenological Interventions in Art History and Visual Culture. And this is an image of a work of art, Kim Chong-Koo's Mobile Landscape, which is going to feature quite heavily in my talk. It was a piece that I first experienced in 2013 while I was here in the Signature Art Prize exhibition. I was kind of waylaid by this work, and it's meant an awful lot to me since. Just put up how the talk is going to be structured, hopefully in three parts. If I don't quite get to the end, I think hopefully there'll be already enough for everyone to think about, even without that. But hopefully I will get through the whole lot. A few more images of the work of art that I'll be turning back to. Are people familiar with this piece as well? You may. Just to give you a preview. I'm also going to be referencing this piece here, which is a Korean ink painting, of which I'll say more in a minute. So I wanted to start off by talking a little bit about phenomenology. I believe that phenomenology is an incredibly invaluable resource for art researchers. And in the title, I've referred to this idea of enacting sort of phenomenological interventions into our field. So what I wanted to do was say a few things about phenomenology itself, just to set the scene. So broadly speaking, it's a branch of Western so-called continental, as opposed to analytical philosophy, if you want to hang on to those kinds of distinctions, which are not so valid at the moment. And what it does is pay attention not to realities we might rationalise or infer it to be, but as it gives itself to us in perception. So it's often defined as examining in great detail the structures of experience or of consciousness. It's often closely associated with existentialism as well, in that phenomenologists are often concerned to help us best understand and engage with the world as we encounter it in everyday life. It gained philosophical prominence in the early decades of the 20th century, was at its height in the 1940s and 50s, and classical phenomenological thinkers include Edmund Husserl, Martin Heidegger, Maurice Merleau-Ponty, even existentialists like Jean-Paul Sartre, Simone de Beauvoir are often also associated with phenomenology, and indeed Merleau-Ponty collaborated very closely with them. Upon its early emergence, mainly in Germany, phenomenology was almost immediately regarded as significant to several Eastern philosophers as well, most notably argued by Kitaro Nishida in Japan, who founded what was then called the Kyoto School. For instance, Nishida's concept of basho, which is often kind of translated, difficult to translate, but often translated as sort of place or topos, with its non-dualistic concrete logic and his affirmation of contradiction and tension within self-identity, has affinities with a lot of phenomenological thought. And in the 1920s, many Japanese scholars, including several of Nishida's students, travelled to Europe to study under Husserl and Heidegger in Freiburg. Then Korean, later Chinese philosophers also became interested in phenomenology during the 1920s and 30s. And there's still a very, very strong phenomenological tradition in the East to this day. In the West, phenomenology was a mode of thought to be reckoned with, I'd say, until around the 1960s. When it was fairly quickly overshadowed as philosophers tended increasingly to organise their thought around linguistic and semiotic concepts. Also, as cultural studies, deconstruction, post-construction, post-structuralism gained in prominence, many philosophers also tended to become highly critical of the perceptual and particularly the visual arguing against what would be referred to as a dominant and oppressive ocular-centrism of Western Enlightenment-influenced thought, and that sort of anti-ocular attitude that I'm highly sceptical of, I'll say right away. I think it's a bit of a straw man, actually, but we could maybe discuss that later. I think it's very much evident in the field of visual culture. It's actually very anti-visual on the whole, I would say. But only more recently, from the late 1990s, particularly into this century, with the rise of intellectual and academic interest in interdisciplinary fields like visual culture, despite what I've just said, also material culture, the so-called new materialisms, etc., there's a renewed interest in phenomenology. Now, my own research is very much focused on the work of Maurice Merleau-Ponty, his emphatically non-dualistic phenomenological thought. His writings range from work published in the late 1930s up until 1961 when he died, and his particular quest was to reinvigorate Western philosophy by challenging the then dominant streams of rationalism on the one hand, empiricism on the other, and to try and reconceptualize our understanding of the nature and scope of thought outside of or apart from or alternative to those logics. So he's been variously described as a philosopher of embodied subjectivity and as a philosopher of ambiguity. And he's recognised for his lifelong commitment to the study of our perceptual and especially our visual experiences of the world, although he didn't regard sight as separate or cut off from the rest of the sensorium. Significantly, and this is why I was particularly drawn to him, he took the experiences of artists, particularly painters, as paradigmatic for the development of his own thought. So still within the context of introducing phenomenology, I think four insights found in the preface to Merleau-Ponty's Phenomenology of Perception are worth considering, and they'll map onto what I have to say later. In the first place, phenomenology is described as the study of essences, for instance, the essence of perception. But, as he says here, what it also does is a mode of philosophy that puts essences back into existence. So again, you see this sort of non-dualistic sort of current in his thinking. And you can also sort of see the sense of this ambiguous territory that's opening up here. He also described phenomenology as a style of thinking, as something that was really being practiced long before it was kind of formulated into a particular kind of, I suppose, before terms and labels were attached to it. So it was something that was kind of operating a little bit under the radar in a sort of unnamed, perhaps unarticulated way. He describes it as a form of a matter of describing, not of explaining or analysing. And this is something I'm going to be really focusing on, the importance of that first step of describing and what that opens up before. Often, I think, I've noticed it in students' work, I notice it in so many situations that we tend to rush to want to provide an answer or provide a solution to something. And the sense of holding back and first taking time to really actually try and describe in as much detail as possible what the situation at hand is something that I think tends to be jumped over for many different reasons, and this insists on us sort of dwelling in that place. And finally, there is that sense of phenomenology really focusing on particularity and situatedness, and in particular being focused on my own particular point of view. But importantly for Merleau-Ponty, this particular point of view is always characterised by openness and, as already mentioned, by ambiguity and degrees of necessary irreconcilability or non-reconcilability. So it's a very sort of open and kind of contested space, and that is not seen by him as being problematic. That's just how things are. So his position very much is that this individuality, this situatedness, doesn't cut us off from others, but actually, if we can live and act and teach and do whatever we do out of it, it actually becomes our point of deepest connection with others. And in a 1952 essay called Indirect Language and the Voices of Silence, we read indeed that we are grafted to the universal by that which is most our own. And that's, of course, a quote that you could spend hours thinking about. The context of it is, in fact, his discussion of the communicability of modern art. There were all these debates about the fact that modern art, with all of its diverse styles, and it's the sort of sense of painting having become sort of stylistically sort of fragmented, that actually it had lost its capacity to communicate. And Merleau-Ponty takes the opposite position. So that quote is actually embedded in this one. Modern painting presents the problem of knowing how one can communicate without the help of a pre-established nature. So it's not communication through various norms and already established communicative sort of structures or systems. So without the help of a pre-established nature, which all men's senses open upon, the problem of knowing how we are grafted to the universal by that which is most our own. And this brings me to a few things I just wanted to say about phenomenology and art. There's by now a fairly long, although somewhat submerged, phenomenological tradition where art history and theory are concerned. It, of course, came to the fore in the mid-20th century in these explorations of so-called minimalism, particularly in its sculptural formations as here. And, of course, it also has tremendous relevance for various forms of installation art. In other words, in works that were famously described by the American theorist Michael Fried as theatrical because they required the viewer's embodied experiences of perceiving in order to activate them and to bring them into being as art. It's fair to say that the fate of phenomenological, such a hard word to say, phenomenological engagements with art in the light of sort of various post-1960s trends in art, so the semiotic turn in art history, the rise of critical theory, identity politics, the anti-ocular character of much theorising, the turn towards highly conceptualised approaches to art making and so on, map pretty much onto the whole sort of situation, the fate of phenomenology within continental philosophy as I just described it. But again, with the opening up of visual and material cultures, and with many thinkers within new materialisms having been influenced, in fact, by phenomenology, and particularly the work of Merleau-Ponty, with its perceptual and embodied orientations. And indeed, its focus quite often in Merleau-Ponty is a real focus, not even on subject, not on subject-object relationships, but on a sort of a sense of intercorporeality, you know, where there's this very sort of interesting sort of modality that's made centre. And if we talk about subjects or objects, those are kind of secondary. They are kind of derivatives that come out of this sort of much more sort of embedded and complex intercorporeal scene. So the situation is turning around and there's a lot more interest now in phenomenology. Nonetheless, and this brings me back to the reason saw that the urgency, the reasons, the inspiration for this workshop is that, as far as I'm aware, despite there being this kind of, you know, fairly distinguished phenomenological tradition in art history, there are no explicitly phenomenological methodological resources for students and scholars of the history of art theory and visual culture. Explicitly phenomenologically based resources do exist within other fields of inquiry in which the study of images may play a role, so media studies, visual sociology, anthropology, cultural studies, psychology, health studies, etc. But what I found quite disconcerting is that when you look at the visual methodology textbooks that are produced for students working in this field, is that absolutely no reference is made and no contributions are garnered from those who should be the most invested, and indeed I'd argue are the most invested in working closely and intimately within the visual field, namely artists, art historians and practitioners of visual culture. There's an absolute sort of lack of work by us, if you like, being seen as somehow relevant and transferable to these other areas. So according to the clinical psychologist Kate Gleason, who writes around these topics, She talks about the fact that researchers working in fields such as art history and visual culture, I'm quoting her, tend to be more relativist in terms of evidentiary claims, less apologetic and more creative in their analyses of images. Analytic process, she says, is rarely made explicit, and assumptions about replication and generalization are set aside in favor of truth claims based on sound argument and theoretical support. Those engaged in semiological analyses do provide a greater level of detail about analysis, but tend to incorporate substantial theoretical baggage, as she calls it, and they offer no clear method for conducting analysis. So part of Gleason's project, and mine as well, I'd say, or an aspect of what I'm interested in, is to sort of insist on maintaining the positive aspects of this kind of more open, creative, free-flowing, intuitive, you know, pre-critical kind of approach that's often adopted to research, but nonetheless, while beginning, as she puts it, in, she describes it as a more fuzzy way. It's often the way in which the kind of work in our field gets described by people working in the sciences and the social sciences. Finding a way of discovering how to push further and find ways of becoming more methodologically explicit so that what we do may have a sort of wider currency. However, I'd want to kind of insist that it doesn't get sort of ossified into some kind of system, you know, that we're not sort of saying, look, here's a system and bang, apply it onto all sorts of other things. That's absolutely against or it opposes the whole sort of sense and spirit of phenomenological research. I came across IPA, Interpretative Phenomenological Analysis, which seemed more difficult to say, a few years ago. It's mostly practiced by researchers in psychology, health field, the field of health studies, etc., the social sciences. But I was drawn to it because it really enables researchers to negotiate openness of investigation with a lot of rigor in terms of analysis and interpretation. And so one of the things I'm interested in doing is looking at how some of aspects of that kind of approach might be taken up within the context of art-based research. And there's a key textbook by Smith, Flowers and Larkin called it's Interpretative Phenomenological Analysis, Theory, Method, Research. It's the kind of classic book. They describe IPA as being concerned with a detailed examination of human lived experience. And it claims to conduct this examination in a way which, as far as possible, this can never be complete, enables that experience to be expressed in its own terms rather than according to predefined category systems. So it's a way of eliciting information that is constantly concerned to try and sort of also expose and dismantle presuppositions that might be sort of floating in the waves. It's a very sort of circular process. Of these constant kind of dispossessions, if you like. So I think that phenomenology is an IPA as well. I think aspects of it are very well suited, particularly to work that's been done in emergent fields, I would say in all fields, but particularly in fields where you don't want to just impose sort of existing knowledges or assumptions or methodologies onto material, but you want to try and have a sense of engaging with what seems to be emerging and actually sort of have a sense that these phenomena may sort of incorporate hints, if you like, within themselves of how we might want to engage with them. And in this way, perhaps, you know, find ways of making some of the, I think, very important insights that we discover in our work. We talked about quite a lot of them this morning in the first workshop, you know, how they can become sort of more generally applicable to others working even outside of art history, visual culture. There is one reference I just wanted to make to a field of study that's been emerging sort of alongside my interest. Again, I mentioned it in the first workshop, so apologies to you who were there. It's, I don't know if you've come across it, it's called Visual Thinking Strategies. And it's something that's been developed by various thinkers in a very empirical way, actually, over the years. And what's valuable about it, this particular paper by Philip Janowine, if anybody wants a copy, I've got a PDF on my computer somewhere. It's very valuable because it presents very strong arguments backed with evidence for the centrality and broad application of these visual thinking strategies. And these strategies consist of a process in which the teacher or the facilitator will encourage students first to look at works of art, then building on these observational skills. They're asked, in fact, three questions when they're confronted with these images. They're asked what's going on or what's happening in this picture, what do you see that makes you say that? So this is a sense of, it's not enough to say, oh, this is happening and that's happening, but why precisely are you saying that this or that is happening? Encouraging people to find ways of articulating that. And then what more can you or can we find? And from this, the argument is that these very rich skills are developed, not just in observation, but further skills in inferring, in offering evidence, in speculating from possible conclusions, and also in terms of revising opinions. So there's this real sort of intensity of sort of cognitive capacities that emerge within these explorations of images that then can be transferred into other fields. They've done a lot of work with kids in school. What they also do is they make a very strong claim for starting with art, arguing that for those who are sighted, developmentally, skills in looking as a route to learning predate our use of texts, our use of numbers, and that even though, due to the ways in which we've been educated, the latter tend to take over, these visual skills can quite easily be reactivated. And as an aside, in the exhibition that's currently on, that's why I've put this up, in the ICA here, there's a piece by Hirako Sawa called Lineament. I don't know if you've seen it. And that really seems to open up this sort of scene, if you like, where somebody who has awoken and lost all capacity, lost memory, lost the capacity to speak, has forgotten everything, is trying to become reacquainted with the world in some kind of way. And there's again that real sense of this very sort of physical, bodily, tactile, visual form of engaging with the world, but it's also a world that actually somehow is allowed to operate in all sorts of different, unexpected ways. It's very interesting piece, I think, and worth taking a look at. So that was a little aside. What they also do in their text is really talk about the sort of the sense of density, as I said, that's contained within visual images. And again, as I said earlier, they talk about the fact that virtually all aspects of cognition come into play as we engage deeply with visual images, including the structures of feeling, for instance. So I wanted to move on to this idea of starting from below. And hopefully from what I've already said, you'll already have quite a good sense of what I mean by this, because I've already been presenting a lot of, you know, sensibilities that are attached with that. The quote itself is from Merleau-Ponty's first book called The Structure of Behaviour, where he says we will come to these questions by starting from below. And it was in the context of that perceptually grounded route into trying to challenge the mind-body dualism that were dominating philosophical thought at the time. And in many ways, in a sort of at a sort of de facto level, certainly in the West, I don't know what the situation is here. There's still that sense that we tend to be constantly slotting into that those dualistic either or yes no ways of thinking. So just to pull things together, I just wanted to associate the wisdom of starting below within the context of discussion of research methodologies by making a few points. So some of the issues that are kind of really validated from this sort of phenomenological starting from below perspective is first the value of pre-critical forms of engagement with primary sources. We just did a bit of that in the workshop when we used drawing to try and articulate or to try and think through drawing rather than think cognitively about our teaching practices or about important learning practices that have been important to us. And again, it's incredible what actually we end up putting down on paper. We might think we can't do it or it's impossible to visualise, but it's kind of interesting to see what emerges. The role and power of description as a key phenomenological method, and I'll be focusing on that in the remainder of the talk. The use of visual skills like drawing, diagramming and mapping, enacting, we could add that to the list as well. And the critical value of the personal, situated and ideographic. And ideographic, again, refers to the sense of dealing with a particular nature of phenomenological research. So these are all issues that I already raised. This idea of description and what it can do. So again, I'm really interested in description as a kind of as a form of agency. And again, a few statements. Now, first of all, in terms of thinking about what description is and does, I mean, usually when the word description is used, it's often preceded by the word mere. So mere description, it's merely perceptual and thus not intellectual or critical. It's often regarded as decidedly uncritical, and indeed it is positioned in phenomenology as pre-critical. It's merely imitative, thus inconsequential, ineffectual, it's not adding anything new, it's not involved in the hard work of analysis and critique. And also often the view is that because it's so perceptual, it's often also sort of unhelpfully subjective, opening up experiences that are non-communicable. I think I've already pre-addressed some of those issues. But phenomenology, as I've just said, offers a radically different perspective. Merleau-Ponty, in the context of his quest, defined the first philosophical act as a matter of, I quote, describing our perceptual experiences of the world, rather than trying to presuppose. So it's describing our perceptual experience of the world before presupposing it. And this is the terrain that he said that philosophy, and indeed all the other forms of knowledge seeking, the sciences too, this was the realm, the terrain that all of these disciplines needed to sort of re-embed themselves into. So what exactly does phenomenology, and particularly Merleau-Pontian phenomenology, have to say about description and its capacities? And there are a lot of claims I could make, but again, I just want to make four. So one, and this very much, if you look up description in a dictionary and look for synonyms, often it says things like label or define. But actually, this phenomenological definition of description is really the opposite of that. It's actually much more about becoming progressively, and the progressive aspect is important, progressively involved in a process that dispossesses me of pre-constituted categorizations and judgment. Earlier I talked about this notion of, it's called the hermeneutic circle. As I engage with an object, I begin to, and really, really sort of, you know, just sit in front of it, I begin to see that I'm also the recipient of, it is, you have the sense that it is communicating with you. And as a result, it kind of repositions you, it changes something in you, which then repositions you so that your involvement with the object has changed because you've become repositioned, which then opens up other perspectives, other angles of the object that are then able to communicate themselves to you, which again, so it's this sort of ongoing iterative process, which is very much at the heart of this sort of phenomenological method. Description enables me to find a home within the visual and its difficulties so that it becomes a site of openings. For me, this is very important because, as I said, maybe it's just in Britain, I don't know, but there's such a sort of resistance to the visual, such a resistance to actually sort of entering into this realm and really attending to what gives itself to us in perception. And I think there are many reasons why that is. I think experiencing being looked at can be incredibly threatening. It's often a realm that we prefer to evade in different ways. But of course, the visual can't be reduced to all of these debates around the gaze and about objectification. In fact, I'd argue that those are examples of not seeing, in fact, or of prosaic vision, not the profound levels of visuality that Merleau-Ponty's thought opens up. Description teaches me how to attend, and here again, to attend involves positioning myself in service of another. and of a self-showing world. And finally, description turns things around. It turns them inside out, upside down. It expands my vision. So what I want to do now is move to the discussion of Kim Chongku's mobile landscape. And just wanted to give a little bit of context first. It's part of an ongoing research project. I give a paper at a conference in June. And the project was very much a philosophical project based on Merleau-Ponty's thought, and particularly as an idea, a metaphor that he uses a lot when he's discussing this idea of transformative thought. And it's the metaphor of the hinge or the pivot. And as I've been sort of thinking about this work, somehow mobile landscape just kind of kept, you know, imposing itself upon me. So I've really been trying to work with it as I've been thinking through these issues. And I'm now sort of developing it into a longer essay. And I think it might be worth just saying a few things about what I'm trying to argue, just to set the scene. So the aim is very much to make a case for the practical, existential, and indeed problem-solving capacities of phenomenology and phenomenological aesthetics. So in the first place, I'm trying to present phenomenological aesthetics as a mode of investigation. I'm arguing that if it's deployed, it's very effective in terms of turning around or transforming situations of the worst kind. And by these, I mean situations that are experienced as hopelessly entrenched in conflict, threat, or harm, where no attempts at resolution seem to work. So when you're totally stuck. In The Phenomenology of Perception, Merleau-Ponty wrote in this regard of a subject who remains open to the same impossible future, if not in his explicit thoughts, at any rate in his actual being. And we can recognise similarly entrenched structures of behaviour in other contexts, ranging from the personal to the administrative and to the political. And my claim is that the only way to turn around in the sense of transforming or resolving trouble of this intractable kind is by developing ways of sort of turning around within these situations, and also of being turned around within them. And this second sense of turning around, which provides an alternative to the classical responses of trouble, to trouble of either flight, fight, or frozenness, has in the first instance to do with sort of developing or having developed this perceptual flexibility, which, following Merleau-Ponty, opens up dimensions of unanticipated but effective emotional, intellectual, and strategic capacity. So, mobile landscape. What interests me with this is not only the way in which, obviously, I engage with it very much by using processes of description myself. And again, I'm still at quite an early stage of being involved with this piece. But also, I see Kim Chongku himself being involved or opening up various dimensions of description, as I've actually just been describing it, through his material involvements. And I'll also be bringing in this work here, which I'll say a little bit about. I'll probably run out of time, but I'll try and get there. And this work I discovered in a really fortuitous way on the way to the conference. I discovered that Harvard and one of the art museums has this wonderful collection of Southeast Asian art, including quite a few Korean ink drawings. So I was able to say a little bit about the work based on just seeing the piece online, and I incorporated that into my paper. But I had the wonderful experience of actually begging them and being allowed to spend a wonderful hour, my idea of absolute heaven, in the archive in the study centre there with the work, spending an hour just looking, photographing, drawing, looking again, talking, you know, all of that. And it was such an exciting, a revelatory experience for me. And I will say a few things at some of my beautiful drawings. Okay. Am I still doing all right? Because I know you want to have discussion, don't you? It always happens, doesn't it? You sort of run out of time. Anyway, so in The Visible and the Invisible, Merleau-Ponty talked about the fact that it's at the same time true that the world is what we see and that nonetheless we must learn to see it. So there's that sense of this philosophical journey that has to begin with these processes of dispossession, of letting go of what we think we know or letting go of how we think we should even proceed. So there's that sense of getting involved in a journey downwards, a journey that starts or that needs to start from below. It's also worth adding that description itself is etymologically related to this notion of belowness or downness. The prefix D from the Latin means down, down from, down to the bottom, totally, completely, as well as meaning things like as, from, of, concerning. And even scribere, to write, comes from a Proto-Indo-European root, scrib, which means to cut, separate, sift. So again, there's that sense of processes in which things are being somehow broken down. So again, a few shots of the piece. So mobile landscapes actually been shown in multiple locations when it was since it's been first been made, but what you're aware of straight away is that you're entering into a space of inscription where calligraphic marks written in black powder have been deposited on expanses of white paper. Our sense is that the powder is unfixed and thus vulnerable to our presence, potentially to our very breath. We find ourselves walking through and looking down upon a fragile scene. We also immediately find ourselves in the midst of filmed projections, and we become aware that we're not the only ones looking. Kim's installation includes closed-circuit cameras placed at floor level, which continuously survey the work and broadcast what they see. From their perspectives, the small-scale mounds of raw materials that we look down upon take on the screened scale of vast mountainous landscapes. Given the trace materials at our feet, we might experience the installation in forensic terms as aftermath. Certainly, there is the feeling of having entered a space in which raw materials and basic communicative modes, structures and systems, some ancient, some contemporary, have been laid out and laid open for our consideration. With the installation's strong emphasis on horizontality, vista, far-seeing, and seeing both from above and beneath, along with the artist's insertions of verticality by means of those projected pictures. At a schematic level, a familiar grid scenario that has been so repeatedly activated within modernity, just one example of the grid, functions I think in many cultures, and the structures of perception, communication, containment, and exposure associated with it are decomposed. In those coexistences of human and CC sight we're situated in this piece, to cite Merleau-Ponty from The Visible and the Invisible, we're in what he calls intermundane space. It's a pell-mell ensemble of bodies and minds, promiscuity of visages, words, actions, and between them all that cohesion which cannot be denied them, since they are all differences, extreme divergences of one same something. We also find ourselves in an expanded space from which, and I think, yes, in an expanded space in which it seems the seeings and showings of other times are also involved, somehow sustained, but within difference, so not mimetically. For as the CC cameras transform Kim's powdery scripts, his writings, into those mountainous expanses, we're aware on multiple levels that Kim's practice is intertwined with a pictorial and intellectual tradition, which it's at once referencing and reorganizing. That of Korean and more broadly Chinese, specifically literati ink and brush painting, a tradition with a long and varied history, which over the centuries has often reinvented, developed, and been protected by these scholar painters, within contexts of imposed or self-imposed exile or exclusion on, or self-exclusion sometimes, on ideological grounds. So here, within this depiction of gentlemen, the piece is called Landscape with Gentlemen Visiting a Scholar in a Lakeside Pavilion. Here, the gentlemen within the depicted landscape are moving towards a particular space of thinking and rethinking the scholar's pavilion, which in this tradition, as with the landscape itself, in fact, is also taken to be a figuration of the scholar painter's sort of inner life and values. And of course, what's really interesting about, for me, the pavilion is its fragility. There's a kind of luminosity. There's a sense that it's hovering, not only on the edge of the lake, but between the visible and the invisible. And I think we can see how Kim's piece is sort of engaging, or might be a variation of paintings of this kind. Also of note is the fact that the gentleman's journey to the scholar's secluded pavilion at the edge of that lake is also very much a journey down. Even the figures at the front here, who are temporarily going up, are going to descend again to reach the pavilion at their journey's end. But it's not only a particular tradition that's being kind of both, you know, recalled and decomposed or reorganized in different ways. Mobile landscape is also, in a sense, dispossessing us or giving us a space in which we experience being dispossessed. When seen in isolation, the mountainous projections, I'll go back to this one again, look immobile, frozen. In reality, of course, they're moving images, and this sense of mobility is embedded everywhere in the piece, in actuality and also in potential. And this becomes more than apparent when, having entered the space ourselves, we discover that we too are being picked up by the camera and relocated, redistributed, and differently composed. So without a capacity to anticipate it, our bodies, our lower extremities, our feet, are suddenly and unaccountably, so it seems, on display. As we literally turn about in our physical ruminations of the work, we're pulled apart and scattered. Multiple forms, in fact, are at issue in this piece: people, materials, viewpoints, bodies. Once again, that pell-mell ensemble of bodies and minds, promiscuity of visages, words, actions, etc. So at the one hand, this is a kind of vital space in which we're literally being repositioned. And as such, it's sort of almost like rehearsing our flexibility, helping to make it dispositional. And it's kind of releasing the insight that other possibilities, alternatives are there, are kind of hovering and waiting. On the other hand, it's also a scene that can't really be described as entirely hospitable. It's a troubled terrain. We've seen that it's fragile, it's unstable. It's a space with obstacles over which you can trip. But because of all of this, it's a space where learning and change can also take place. Again, as Merleau-Ponty put it in Institution and Passivity, it's on the basis of the given obstacle that I will learn. He also talks about the fact that, in spaces like this, we might experience the often necessarily violent transitions from what I have to what I aim to be, from what I am to what I intend to be. So it's a space of effortful making. And one of the things that I haven't said yet is the fact that the black powder that Kim uses is black steel that he himself has ground down using this very sort of laborious process, working with steel bars or rods, which are of course the basic infrastructural units upon which modern industrial society has been assembled. So there's this kind of behind the scenes, this sort of invisible labour, where the artist has taken a sort of fundamental block entity and ground it down even further. And I like to think of Kim in this regard as positioned in his version of that sort of pavilion, understood as a place where intellectual and artistic work that is invisible is already taking place. And a final point, Kim's space of labour is also a very emotional place that seems as though it must be coaxed into life. We're told that when he works, he's often mumbling to himself and to the work as if he's kind of trying to coax it into existence, if it's a kind of living thing. He's spoken of calligraphy as an extension of the body and breath. So again, etymologically, he's writing, he's describing in a kind of dispossessive way. But as he does this, as he's working and bending and moving around in this pulverized world, we see that it's also a very generative space in which something is taking place. I'm going to skip over this. It's a beautiful quote, but I'm going to move over that so that we can get back to the point that I want to make. And there's a sense of poise in this position, and it relates to, actually, I realise, a lot of images about learning or sites of learning that I've been quite drawn to, where there are these individuals who are in this incredibly poised and attentive position. So this is the Anatello da Messina, St. Jerome in his study, and this is another one that I sort of constantly come back to, which is the boy building a house of cards. And what really interests me about this are, there's a sense, on the one hand, of this very relaxed hand that sort of flopped on the table, and then this other hand that is required to do this very precise work. And there's this kind of negotiation of both precision and a kind of utter sort of relaxation. The poise is also there in this piece. When I first looked at this ink drawing, I thought that the triangular form in the centre of the pavilion was just a kind of decorative feature. But when I looked more closely at the work, I saw that there was a kind of code being enacted. So right at the top, there are these little lines, figures, and that are just like little dashes. In the mid-ground, and you see this particularly in the boat, that a language of the triangle is used to depict forms, and then in the beginning, in the foreground, these are fluid forms. So I realise the triangular form, which is of course both very stable and dynamic, is the philosopher himself. But just to end, and this is my final quote, one of the things that became really interesting for me was the sense that with this kind of intentive inaction that I referred to earlier, that sort of sense of needing to wait and be still rather than rush to conclusions, that that it's a kind of non-instrumentalized space, but it's a space in which therefore we're open to the sense of the possibility of vision being expanded. And one of the quotes that I came across within my interest in Merleau-Ponty and The Hinge was this one, where he talks about a world, we live in intersubjectivity, we could add intercorporeality, a world with several possible entrances. We are one for the others. Me, others, hinge, which is common life, like me, my body, hinge, which for me is not just weight, a curse, but also my flywheel. Accompany others, history, and not just endow it with sense by decision. This is one of the notes at the end of one of the notes in Institution and Passivity. And one of the things I discovered, this notion of the flywheel, that in that sense of within these kind of quite difficult situations, a weight becomes a flywheel. A flywheel, as I'm sure you know, is a mechanical device. It's like a heavy disc or a wheel rotating around a shaft, and it's specifically designed to efficiently store rotational energy, and then it gives, as a result, an almost uniform rotational speed to the shaft and to all connected machinery. And what I discovered, to my amazement, actually, when I was really studying this image in the Resource Centre, was as I looked at it really closely, not only was it an image that had this sort of strong sense of moving downwards, as I looked more closely, having already sort of spotted, you know, the scholar in this incredible space of the pavilion, I suddenly realised that if you moved sort of slightly upwards here, there was another sort of axis, another kind of pivot here, the centre of the tree, that seemed to have all these spokes running off it. So suddenly this image suddenly seemed to be organised around this flywheel that wasn't actually centred on the scholar himself, but sort of slightly kind of above and to the side. And for me, that was extraordinary, because that I hadn't expected to find that. I wasn't even looking for it, but suddenly with that sort of emerging again, the way in which this image suddenly, there's a whole other sort of energy that begins to circulate in it. And with these words, I end. And thank you for sticking with me.
Is there one up for questions? I mean, if anyone has any burning questions that you could ask.
Otherwise, I'm around at lunch, so you can ask as much as you want. Yes?
Could I have the last slide of yours on descriptions before part three?
Yes. I mean, do you want me to give it to you, or do you want
could
to see it?
Again,
tell me when to stop.
Before part three.
Oh, yeah, you mean the four statements, you mean?
And I think it's very useful, I will speak for some of my students who are here, to hear you talk about phenomenology and its relationship to specific artists and their artworks.
Yeah.
So thank you for that.
You're welcome.
This question whether he had any influence on the post structuralist, you know, I mean.
Well,
this thing about subjectivity.
I know. Some.
Open-endedness.
I think there's. Partly as a result of sort of Foucault writing about Deleuze, etc., there's been a lot of misconception about phenomenology. A lot of thinkers have characterised it as foundational, whereas in fact the writing, I mean, there are many sort of variations of phenomenology, particularly Merleau-Pontian phenomenology is anti-foundational in that sense. So it's a good question, because indeed he didn't influence necessarily post-structuralist thought. I think they tended to regard him as this old kind of humbug who likes Cézanne, etc. But actually what he was doing and how he was thinking actually kind of predated and anticipated a lot of what they were doing. And I think it's only now as people are returning to his work and looking at it more carefully that they're beginning to see. One of the issues with Merleau-Ponty is that what he tended to do as his form of argumentation was that he'd insert himself in the argument in the arguments he was trying to dismantle, and he'd ventriloquise them. And so, of course, what often happens is that if he's not read carefully, people will actually, you know, associate the very ideas he's criticising with his own thought, and that's where quite a lot of confusion has emerged. Yeah. Yes.
I thought it was a lovely talk, and I loved the words that you used. They were very evocative, they were metaphoric, they evoked the art you were talking about. And so I think you've got description here several times. I think description in terms of writing, like you're doing, relies on words.
Yeah.
And, you know, the words that you're using and to evoke the art through words, I think is a special skill, which you obviously have. But I think might be difficult.
Do you know what? I find it really difficult. And often when I'm writing, it's the bit that I really kind of drag my feet about. Because it's so hard, because you finding that language.
Yeah.
So I often find myself that I don't even sometimes like doing it. I have to kind of really force myself, and it's always the hardest bit, but it's always the most valuable bit, because it's often, you know, when you get stuck with writing or with ideas, often there's a great writer called Jack Flam, who's a journalist, but he often says that if you got stuck somewhere in the writing process, you need to go back a step. You know, don't keep trying to push forward. You need to go back, and because there's something you need to do that you haven't done yet. And I think often that's just describing. And so I find that it's actually by doing these careful descriptions that you actually begin. It's like the flywheel thing, that now I feel it's sort of added a dimension to this paper that I'm trying to work on, that hopefully I'll be able to incorporate. So, yeah. It's also the struggle Merleau-Ponty had. You know, he's looking at the work of painters. He's looking at thinking about their experiences. He's trying to deal with philosophy that has a very particular language that's built around all these oppositions, and he's trying to sort of find a language to express his non-dualistic thinking. It's incredibly, he ends up finding all sorts of sort of poetic terms which have problems of their own. So yeah, this issue of words, language is, thank you.
But what you're describing, you seem also to be analysing and interpreting.
Well, this is the thing. I think, you know, it's the all these accusations of description being kind of useless, right, and all the rest of it. Because immediately, as soon as you're kind of digging in, you are inevitably, in the very way that you open up things, in a sense, analysing, I think. But, yeah.
I think as well, where the power of description from phenomenology and from what you were saying in his preface about essences, it's about actually describing and condensing and really bringing out the essence of things.
Yeah.
I think that's where the real power of, you know, of phenomenology and arts is concerned. And I think in theatre and dance and so on, because of the embodied, say, motive quality in phenomenology has always been very important.
Yeah.
I think increasingly in visual art. But I think where the big link between Merleau-Ponty and phenomenology and deconstruction and Derrida and so on is actually in that search for essences and ontologies that in Merleau-Ponty's and those traditional existentialists think are about truth, big truth. Whereas Derrida says, okay, well, I don't believe in truth, but I want to look at the fractures of the disjunction, but also find the absolutes, the essences, and the ontologies in those flaws, in those intertextualities, etc. So it's a different form of truth, and it's a looking askance rather than looking for the universal. So it's just,
however, having said that, his notion of universal is extreme divergencies. Of, he hangs on to this idea of one something, so he refuses to let go of that sense that there is something, but it's always through the differences and divergencies. So there's always cracks and crevices, and this quote that I tripped over, maybe I shouldn't have, but talks about the fact that, you know, we all have these areas of lack. You know, there's that sort of disjunctured sense of selfhood. It's not kind of self-contained. If it was, we would never learn anything. We'd never have any need for engagement with others. But he talks about the fact that we all lack different things. You know, our lacks are all different, and it's through those sorts of engagements. So again, I think there's not as much difference actually between them, except for the fact that he does want to hang on to this sense that there are these sort of deep underlying threads that hold us together. And I think that's also one of the reasons why he's becoming more interesting to a lot of people now, because there is that sense of a kind of, it's not holistic in a closed sense, but there's a sense that there are these very, very deep patterns. It's not just about fracture, you know, and it's not just about things endlessly sort of spinning out and diversifying, but he has this model of the chiasm, and it's a form like the Greek X, which crosses, but it also loops back on itself. So that's his. So it's always about things passing, but things loop back in. So there's constantly that sort of sense of circling and reconnecting in different ways, I think. Yeah. Yes, Claire.
When you were talking through all of this, I was just thinking about how many parallels there are between Merleau-Ponty and feminist scholarship.
Yes.
And I wanted to ask you if this is also something that features in your work, or if feminist scholars have taken up this idea of phenomenology as well.
Yeah. Merleau-Ponty is often thought of as not engaging at all with feminism, identity, but that's often how he's characterised, because he doesn't deal with those sort of labels and definitions in that particular way. What he tends to do, I think, is actually undo those sorts of notions of identity in the first place, and he's very interested in intercorporeality, etc. Having said that, though, there is, there's a book, a publication, was Feminist Readings of Merleau-Ponty, and I know quite often in work I've done, people have said things, they've said her feminist approach, so obviously and I think he has a lot of metaphors in his writing that are very feminine, you know, So I think, and he was very sort of closely involved with people like Simone de Beauvoir while she was doing her work. So I think in a very deep way, he was highly engaged with identity politics, in the sense of he did a lot of, quite a lot of international travel where he was looking at all sorts, he was very political, looking at all sorts of issues to do with race and labour and conditions, colonialism, all the issues with France's relationships and the colonies, etc. I think there is a lot of there are certain parallels, but at the same time I think the directions that Merleau-Ponty goes in, and what interests me about him, is that it's not the kind of, so I think there's a kind of identity politics where it's becoming increasingly kind of hyphenated and very, very sort of label heavy. And I think with him there's a different kind of sensibility about how he's trying to think through issues around, who and how we might like to think of ourselves in relationship to others, where perhaps maybe those labels don't function in quite that way. But yeah, do take a look at that book. I mean, people like Irigaray were quite critical of him. I think a lot of them did think he was a bit of an old chauvinist in some ways, but when you look more deeply at how he writes and things he says, you think, no, he's not at all. There's really something very liberating in his thinking, for everybody, I think, not just for white males as much as, why should they be always picked on, as far as I'm concerned, so yeah, did that answer the question? Yeah.
All right, thank you.
I managed without coughing, thank God. Amazing. I think your lemon juice really helps.
I was just thinking, when you were going through, when we come to on the course on it, because I don't want words.